Those who share in the Golden's dedication towards liberation of the human race, we present to you
the Authorian Snatchina.
Your favorite anarchist radio show with the radical analysis of the news, reports from the front lines of the struggle, and a healthy reminder of what is real in this land of confusion. Join us Monday through Friday from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time, where you can call in and ask questions, tip us off to an action in your area, or just tell us what's on your mind. Let the Authority Smash begin.
Hello, wage slaves, once again to the Authority Smashing Hour, your daily anarchist radio show on the internet. And tonight, with your host, Mr. 1001 Nights, and later on, Paul will call he's a regular listener, and he's going to be hosting the show once a week, starting probably later this week or maybe next week. So we'll have him on the line. As well as, of course, the questions and the thoughts of people in the chat room. And whoever wants to call in, I'll remind you the number is 646-716-8106. Once again, 646-716-8106. And I will post the link on the chat room. I mean, the number on the chat room so that people can call in. And as well, of course, our website, authoritysmashers.wordpress.com, which I will also post on the chat room. And on that website, you'll find our stored shows, as well as any news about the upcoming shows or previous shows. You can leave comments. You can tell us what you want to see reported, or if you want to donate, there's a donation button there. If you have a few dollars to spare, I remind listeners that shows like this are, in place because of the generous attention and donations of people like you. And we have an exciting show ahead of us. A lot of news. A lot of different things to talk about. And as expected, the skewed reality that power structures generate was revealed once again in a statement by Hillary Clinton, in which she said that Islamist terror is the number one threat. And what to say about that? I've repeated over and over again all the things that are much more important than Islamic terror, and that's even, of course, assuming that the United States military and the actions of the U.S. government have not, in fact, created more terrorism as at the same time as the actions and the statements of the government claims to be stopping terror, to prevent terror, or to reduce terrorism. They have increased the threat of terrorism, as it was predicted even before the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, but they went ahead anyway. And once again, that's quite apart from government terrorism itself, which is, as anyone with their head screwed on right knows, it's the biggest kind of terrorism out there. The terrorism of the government is way greater than the terrorism of any subnational group. There's a good excerpt on the meaning, on the real meaning of terrorism, in the 1979 book, The Washington Connection and Third World Fascism, which was written by co-jointly by Edward Herman and Noam Chomsky. And basically, terrorism refers to the violence of official enemies. Primarily subnational groups, but also, of course, state actors that do not comply with the orders of the local mafia don, or the international mafia don, the United States government. Although, of course, this is not a phenomenon, a semantic phenomenon unique to the United States. All the nation states use the word terrorism to bring their citizens, to subordinate themselves to the orders of the government to scare them, which of course is the oldest tactic to scare the population. So Russia talks about terrorism in Chechnya as they slaughtered countless civilians. I mean, this doesn't mean the terror doesn't exist in its subnational form. Of course it does, but very often it's a reaction, it's a creation of the larger terror and larger influence of the nation states that dominate the international system, as well as a diversion from and a distraction from the bigger terrorism of the nation states that, as I said, dominate the international scene. As far as the Islamic terror being depicted as the number one threat, one could just look at the number of people killed. So I've reported on this show many times that in the United States alone, which is supposed to be a rich industrialized country, unlike some place like China, which is still behind in terms of labor rights and so on. Still here, we have about 50,000 workers who die every year from work-related injury and illness, mostly illness. Injury, maybe only about 5,000, maybe only 10% of those are deaths by some accident, but they're mostly illness, exposure to chemicals and other kind of stuff. And that's many 911s, every year. All right, so that's a much bigger threat. Yet the government does not allow, makes it very hard for the workers to unionize. There's all these laws against all kinds of union activity, and it's very well known that the arrangements of the law are there to satisfy capitalist interest, and which means, of course, not allowing unions to fight for their higher wages, for better conditions at work, et cetera, as well as obviously, worker insecurity, which is actually has been proven by some of these right-wing studies that what they call labor flexibility is good for the market. So basically, not knowing if you're going to have a job tomorrow, that's good for the market. But of course, you may studies have shown that people who are insecure about their job, who don't know if they're going to have a job tomorrow. They have very high levels of stress, which cause all kinds of problems to your health. So, I mean, that's a much greater threat right there, the threat of stress, workplace injury and illness, et cetera. Yet that, of course, is not even on the list of biggest threats, much less, of course, the number one. So, what can we make out of this? Statement that Islamist terror is the number one threat. Well, transparently, it's a rationalization for U.S. imperialism. So, they want to take control of certain areas of the Middle East. They want to justify their foreign policy. They want to justify economic, military spending, and therefore you need an enemy. And after the Russians, see, the Russians at least were a nation state. They were a powerful enemy with whom you could actually justify building up nukes and stuff like that. Of course, the pretext was always weak, as has been proven by numerous critics of the Cold War narrative. But nevertheless, at least you had a better rationalization, a better excuse. In reality, actually, the Cold War was a war of the United States against the Third World and Russia against its smaller domains in Eastern Europe. But of course, both sides used each other as a pretext. It was always the Russians. You could always say the Russians are here; they're going to come and get us. So when they wanted to crush independent development in Nicaragua or Vietnam, because they were afraid it would succeed and therefore spread, and of course interfere with the prerogative of big business in the Third World, which is to be supplied with cheap labor and resources. When that was implemented, you know, the destruction of Vietnam and the destruction of Nicaragua and so on, it was always under the threat of, oh, look, the Russians are going to come and get us, you know. So, but now, you know, you have this this new enemy, the Muslims, who the supposedly, you know, there's always, of course, a very vague description, very vague separation between quote unquote Islamic terrorism and Islam itself, which is depicted among right-wing circles as a violent religion, which inherently contains all these evil things, etc., etc., class of civilizations. I mean, they try ex to exaggerate it because they know that the narrow threat of Islamic terrorism, not only is it created by to a large extent by the actions of nation states, of course, the West playing a very important role in that, but also because you cannot justify, you know, new aircraft, you know, trillion-dollar aircraft and wars and weapons, high-tech weapons to fight some guys who are claimed to be in caves hiding somewhere, you know. But nevertheless, it works. Oh yeah, we need a huge military budget, and of course, as we heard this year, freeze everything else. You know, freeze Social Security, freeze all discretionary spending, everything that goes to Medicare, healthcare. Well, actually, I think that perhaps Medicare didn't freeze. But anyway, it was everything, pretty much everything related to spending for people that was frozen, and the military is the most, you know, the most important part of the budget that was not frozen, because that, of course, is a priority in our current system. So, all these things provide us with hints of what really is going on. Well, extending U.S. imperialism abroad to the Israeli client in the Middle East. Palestinians just recently clashed with Israeli police yesterday, and dozens were wounded. It says Palestinian young men and Israeli police clashed on Monday in the Palestinian refugee camp of Shofat, east of Jerusalem, during which dozens of Palestinians, including journalists, were injured. Witnesses, as well as local sources, said that dozens of Palestinian youths and three journalists were lightly and moderately injured, including a cameraman, a photographer, and a local news reporter. I may add, folks, that this happens all the time. I mean, we have people getting killed all the time in Palestine. A few people getting killed today. A few others getting killed. You know, 3 days ago, etc., etc. Always, always violence. Always people getting murdered, and we just don't we don't see the pattern. We keep providing Israel with billions of dollars worth of military aid, so-called. It says the clashes erupted when Israeli police forces stormed the entrance of the refugee camp and detained dozens of young men. According to witnesses, the residents threw stones and empty bottles at the police. The police forces were firing rubber bullets and tear gas canisters to disperse the demonstrators. So that's freedom of expression right there. This Shofat refugee camp houses 25,000 residents, most of them refugees, who were expelled from the old city of Jerusalem several years ago. So there you have it, you know, stealing the land, kicking them out, and then they're not even safe in some refugee camp somewhere. The last statement of this article, which is by a Chinese newspaper, I think it's called Xinjiang or something like that. It's always good to actually look at some of these foreign newspapers, because you know, if you just read American corporate media, you're very likely to have an unrealistic picture of the world. So anyway, the last statement of this Chinese newspaper says the Israeli army, it carries out daily raids on Palestinian towns, villages, and refugee camps, saying that they are wanted by Israeli security services. So yeah, that's what it means to be occupied. It's a constant state of surveillance, of harassment, of deprivation of liberty, violence, etc., etc. That, see, that's a real threat right there. You know, of course, we don't hear about that, once again, coming from the mouths of our heads of state. At the same time, the United States is pushing for new sanctions against Iran. And I don't know, but for the past few years, the drums of war have been pretty loud. And I don't know if 2010 will be the year when the war against Iran actually happens. But since they announced they were going to build new nuclear enrichment plants, which they are legally, by the international legal system, entitled to do, now new sanctions are in place. They're passing new sanctions, more hostilities, and apparently you also had some agents that were being paid for by the United States to cause some unrest in Iran. They've been funding subversion activities for a long time, which of course, if it happened here in the United States, we would consider that an act of war. If Iran was actually directly subsidizing groups to overthrow the U.S. government, we would feel justified in bombing Iran. But of course, if anybody in Iran were to say, you know, that they feel justified in bombing the United States for its actions. In fact, you know, think about this. You know, you have all these countries around Iran, you know, Afghanistan, you know, in the neighborhood, like Iran, Afghanistan, you know, Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, all these countries in that area, very close to Iran, that are occupied by the United States. And if Iran had invaded, say, Mexico, Canada, all these places around the United States, the U.S. would feel entitled to bomb Iran, you know? So you don't even need this pretext of subversion or threats. The occupations of countries surrounding the United States would be enough for the U.S. to call to bomb Iran. But of course, if the United States occupies countries around Iran and makes threats, levels threats against Iran, that is not considered a reason for Iran to bomb the United States. In fact, it's considered as a reason for Iran to be more subservient, to do what the U.S. wants. I mean, the values are so reversed. The imperial values are so ingrained in the intellectual culture that it's hard for people to, you know, follow the most basic moral principle, to put yourself in the shoes of somebody else, to apply to yourself the same standards you apply to others. And more imperialism news, the Department of Defense, so-called, really Department of War and Imperialism, is seeking another $146 million for schools in Europe. You guys may not know, but the U.S. does have schools in Europe to basically disseminate American values that would, would benefit the spread of imperial and colonial prerogatives. And it says in Stuttgart, Germany, where I live, by the way, I lived in Stuttgart for a year, it says several new schools would be built in Europe under the Department of Defense's proposed 2011 budget, which calls for spending $146 million on the projects. So this would be in Belgium and in Germany. I may point out, of course, that, you know, there's a lot of people in the United States itself, taxpayer money that should be going to people here who are in need of medical care, Social Security, unemployed. Instead, they're being spent not only on war, but on all these imperial projects abroad. So that's a pretty ominous development there. But, you know, which goes, you know, the thing is that we provide so much evidence that there is such thing as U.S. imperialism. Yet, when you actually try to discuss these things with people on the right or even the left, you know, they think, well, this is maybe, and people liberals may say, well, it's a recent phenomenon. Yeah, maybe with Bush, but you know, and poor Obama is now stuck with all these things. But you know, we're not really imperialistic. It's only a recent development. Maybe these right wing. But you know, if you actually look at the real history of the United States, you'll see that it goes way back to the founding of the country. It's always been like this, but this sort of doctrine that is preached, like that, it basically says, well, we used to be good. I mean, liberals always say this: we used to be good, but now all things have gotten corrupted. I mean, you always hear that. I think Chomsky called it the doctrine of new change, or you know, basically that. That way you can always say, well, you know, we're really good. It's just something just went wrong. It's a little mistake, or we can easily get back to what we were without radical change, since, you know, we were always good except for these last few years. But no, I mean, the truth is that, as I said, the U.S., like other powerful states in the past, is driven by what you would expect in a powerful system, which is the wishes and the economic and power designs of the small elite that runs the country. And that means imperialism, it means exploitation, it means international dominance in various ways. And you know, now of course lately we've seen the rise of other powerful states like China that are competing in some arenas with the United States, especially on the economic realm. And that's bound to be a very significant source of tensions in the upcoming years. Although, as I mentioned yesterday, Russia's nuclear arsenal poses a bigger threat to world peace than China's economic development, which of course is also not very pretty, since it's fraught with you know, ineffable exploitation, and you know, hundreds of millions of people suffering from the exploitation of the capitalist developments there. But nevertheless, those do not threaten so directly the survival of the species as a nuclear holocaust, which could happen in one exchange with Russia, especially given that their systems are not as advanced as the American system. So very often they report false alarms, and there's all kinds of problems with the way in which the scenarios play out in an accidental nuclear war. It could be a few cities blown up. It could be an all-out nuclear war, and from there, you know, who knows, could have a nuclear winter, all kinds of horrible scenarios. Though the slower death of the planet is one in which global warming and the industrial processes of development going on in China right now, and of course ongoing in the United States, those will eventually be the undoing of the planet, unless we impose very, very sharp constraints on their ability to produce all these polluting gases and chemicals. So anyway, so we're approaching the half hour, and I want to remind listeners that you can call in, and the number is 646-716-8106. Once again, 646-716-8106. So I'm going to play a song, and when we come back, we can take some calls, and I think my future co-host, Paul, is going to call for a little bit, introduce himself, in case you don't know him, and I will be talking about today in history. We always do this, where we talk about radical events that happen in history, and I'm going to play 1936, which is a Spanish anarchist song that I have in my, that I posted in my account on YouTube which is Mr. 1001 Nights on YouTube. I posted that with translations because it's a Spanish song and people don't understand what people say, what the singers say. But it's a pretty cool song. Talks about 1936, all the things that were happening, the battle against the fascists and the Stalinists. And if you have time, I suggest you go to my page. Actually, I have that as the featured video, and check it out. It's a cool song, and so I'm gonna play it, and I'll be back in a few minutes taking your calls, and I'll see you in a bit. All right. Hello, back to the Authority Smashing Hour. That was 1936, Spanish anarchist song talking about the struggle of the anarchist against forces such as fascism, Stalinism, and other obstacles to the freedom of the peoples in Spain and around the world. And, well, some people in the chat room are talking about food, I guess, prompted perhaps by the interview on Democracy Now of I think it's Michael Pollan, who talks about the some of the scams of the food industry. I have to say that I took to heart the statement that the healthiest part of the supermarket is the one that doesn't have any advertising, namely the produce section. You know, and before the show, I went up to the supermarket up here, and I always do this. I go to the vegetables and fruit section, and look at what they have on sale, and I always buy that. So I bought a bunch of nice tomatoes on sale, really good with some salt, you know. yeah, sometimes if you go to the vegetable section, buy some of that stuff when it's on sale, because often it's a total rip-off, but, you know, try to get the stuff that's on sale. Also, frozen vegetables are pretty good, you don't have to fall for all that processed garbage that the corporate food sellers try to get you. Let's go back to covering some news. I was going to mention as well I always talk about antidepressants. There's a new study showing that antidepressants reduce the effectiveness of cancer. This Paxil, an antidepressant commonly prescribed to women with breast cancer, can reduce or even abolish the effects of the breast cancer drug tamoxifen, increasing a woman's risk of death, Canadian researchers are warning. So, there you have it, folks. There's so many things against these antidepressants. I reported a few weeks back that the placebo effect of these antidepressants were basically accounting for all the alleged improvements, that, except for very severe cases, most of these antidepressants didn't have more of an effect than a placebo. So, it's a big joke, and yet you have an entire community of educated supposed students of the mind, psychiatrists, psychologists, who end up recommending or prescribing these drugs. Of course, the reality is that the influence, the ideological influence of the corporate industry, the pharmaceutical industries, accounts for the prescription of many of these drugs, not so much the search for the truth of what is harming the human mind and the human spirit, of course, in our capitalist environment, which produces all kinds of alienation, stress, etc., etc. Before I talk about today in history, I wanted to clear something up. I've been trying to correct the very heavy bias of a Wikipedia article called libertarianism. Of course, in the United States, the word libertarianism refers to an extreme right-wing version of capitalism, where you have a laissez-faire capitalism and so on. That's what is called right-wing libertarianism, and they assume that libertarianism refers just to that. But of course, I try to interject in the and the lead of that Wikipedia article on libertarianism that indeed that's not the case, and that we have a tradition of the word libertarianism referring to the anarchist left, the libertarian communism, libertarian socialism, whatever you want to call it. And in fact, I just want to make sure you guys know that the anarchist communist Joseph Dukac, main author of the first libertarian journal Les Libertaires, the libertarian journal, Journal du Mouvement Social in New York, basically a French journal published in New York, which ran between 1858 and 1861, was also the fir this guy was the first person to describe himself as a libertarian. So the anarchist communists were the first ones to use the term libertarian. In fact, this guy actually w wrote a letter to Proudhon in 1857, talking about describing himself as a libertarian. So these people, these so-called right libertarians, they are not at all, entitled to use the word as if it was theirs. I mean, even the flag they use, if you guys have noticed, they have this flag which is diagonally split between a black side and a gold side, which what they've done is take the anarcho-syndicalist flag, which was invented in Spain. It was created in Spain during the anarchist struggles there at the beginning of the 20th century, and they've changed the red for the gold, and now they claim that libertarianism somehow refers to capitalism. Now, libertarianism has always been opposed to capitalism, because how can you have freedom when you have a boss, an authoritarian relationship at the workplace, which pervades the whole society, since the entirety of the economic system pretty much is owned by private bosses. You can only decentralize power, which is of course the main goal of anarchism, by decentralizing workplace relations, and that means not having bosses, having participatory control. And in that regard, I may mention an article that Charnchi sent me earlier. Michael Albert, reported on an experiment. On a, an experiment on it was a study done in where was this? I think it was Indonesia. It was an experiment on direct democracy, and in this experiment, which of course it was kind of mild, but it showed that even though the people did not really change their decisions very much from those of the local elites in terms of the range of decisions they were implementing, they were happier, they were much happier when they took place, when participated in decision making. So it's very important to be able to participate, not only for the outcomes that you get, but for your mental sanity. It's nice to be able to not just be a cog in somebody else's machine, following orders, not having control over your productive life, and therefore not controlling your destiny at all, but being able to having to have a meaningful relationship in with other people in the pursuit of controlling your social environment. And maybe Charnchi can send me that article. Okay, it was an MIT. Okay, it was Michael Albert reported this, but it was a study by someone on MIT. So maybe Charnchi, if you're listening, why don't you post the article on the chat room so that people know? Anyway, we have Paul on the line, and let's see if he's there. Paul?
Hey, what's going on, Jonathan?
Hey, Paul, nice to hear from you. How you doing, man?
Yeah, good. I'm all right. Yourself?
Pretty good, pretty good. So is there anything you
I
want to talk
was wondering
about?
about.
Go
yeah,
ahead.
well, I've never edited a Wikipedia article. How does that work exactly?
You just click on edit, and you can open your own. You
How
can.
does it get? How does it need like what? Like you're having trouble. I remember you mentioned with the police you had trouble using the word hierarchical in the who decides
well
how does it get decided what the official page is?
Well, actually, what happens in Wikipedia, I think it's gotten more authoritarian in some ways, because you have these administrators, and they're appointed and they have more say, but usually
Okay.
You can apply for some of those posts. I haven't, but basically, if you sign for it with a screen name, sometimes you can, if you're an anonymous, and I usually am, you have less say. But if you're an established editor, then you have a little more say. I may say that with that police article, I succeeded in introducing the word private property, because at first they had the police described as merely maintaining order and what was it? Maintaining order and implementing the law, something like that, right? And I said, well, if you're if you're protecting order, or you know, if that's already in the law, right? I said, why don't you talk about protecting property, or because after.
Order.
So anyway, I was able to convince them to introduce the phrase "protect property," and still there after over a month, the police article on Wikipedia. So I'm glad that, because after all, I mean, who's going to deny that that's a very important role that they play, protecting property? Wouldn't you agree, Paul? Paul, you there? I
Can you hear
think,
me?
yeah, I can hear you.
All right. Yeah, I was just saying it's funny because I'm picturing like a former, like a retired police chief who's like that's his he sees that as his calling now to maintain that Wikipedia article, and he's having to argue with an anarchist over the definition. It's just funny to me.
Yeah, I mean it's definitely a kind of a battleground, but this article in libertarianism. You know, it's been hijacked by these right libertarians to a large extent, and I was trying to fight that because, you know, they want to monopolize the term a libertarian. And I mean, in fact, like the links at the very end, usually you have an article, and at the end you have links to more information. So every link that at the end of that article in libertarianism is a link to like some right-wing extremist website, like Cato Institute, or you know, Lou Rockwell. Rockwell or whatever. I mean, all these links to right-wing quote unquote libertarian sites. So
Ron
I
Paul.
yeah, Ron Paul. I mean, it's sort of like you know, they've hijacked the word. So it's pretty messed up, and I don't think we should let them get away with that. It's sort of like you know, they took over the word socialism, now it means something else. They took over the word communism, they took over the word libertarian. I mean, so like every word that anarchists try, of course, in anarchism itself, in mainstream political ideology, often means chaos, disorder, lack of organization, etc., etc.
Right.
So.
Interesting, because the word libertarian, obviously the root word being liberty, which is freedom. It strikes me as this perverse form of freedom to, you know, think of the free market as the regulator of commerce, and you know, you're free to work for a boss or die. That's basically their perfect utopia.
Right.
You know, with no state welfare system, no state interfering in the market. And that's kind of their version of freedom, which strikes me as a very perverse version of freedom. But I suppose freedom is a very malleable term.
Also,
You know,
yeah, go ahead.
well, I mean, if you'd asked somebody in the Taliban what's freedom, he would say, freedom would be me being able to beat my wife if she disobeys me, freedom to practice my religion without foreign intruders coming in and telling me what I should be, you know? And so freedom's a malleable term that varies from person to person, so.
Right, and also our consciousness of freedom. So I mean, I know a lot of working class people who are very right wing, who don't see themselves as being oppressed. But we saw the same thing with women. You know, women 100 years ago, when they couldn't even vote, they didn't, you know, lived in a super patriarchal environment. They didn't notice their own oppression. It took consciousness raising activities for them to even realize it. And I mean, unfortunately, what I have to say is that the rhetoric that is often described, you know, like for example, this article in Libertarianism, it said, well, these anarchists, I mean, sorry, these so-called left libertarians, they are against property. So in other words, you can't even own a piece of bread, you can't own a bed, you know. But of course, what I try to do there is say, no, what we oppose is a property not intended for active personal use. You know, we're in favor of
What is
property.
property?
Right.
UFOs exploited its properties.
That's exactly what I meant to say, but the see, they prefer to have a they don't want the real description of what we stand for, because then they look like they're authoritarians. If you start to describe how, hey, you know, we actually don't like bosses at the workplace, you receive more orders in one day from your boss than you do from the policeman in a year, and that's often the case, you know, then, you know, shouldn't you stand against that authority? But then, you know, they're not against authority. They're against a certain kind of authority, which they perceive as interfering with capitalist prerogatives. And, you know, let's face it. I mean, in which context should we place libertarian capitalism? I think the context of that is the context of an ideology that is serviceable to the status quo.
That's almost totalitarian. I mean, it's a very perverse form of freedom, and it's interesting because I think Chomsky would have a lot to say about how the word libertarian in America has been transformed into this right-wing ideology. It's been essentially hijacked with his linguistics background, and how words can be co-opted and made to not even mean, like if you say communism, it doesn't even mean anything anymore. It's just this abstract thing. Nobody knows what it means. Nobody knows if it means an authoritarian structure with state ownership of the means of production, or is it worker ownership of the means of production? And, you know, these words get co-opted and transformed.
I think even terms like America, I'm fighting for America. It's sort of like, or, you know, these soldiers are serving what? Whom? Oh, was serving America. Well, you know, it's sort of like, describe what you mean by America. Do you mean the people, you know, implementing policy? Do you mean the United States as a whole, every single person? What do you mean by America? It's sort of like people talk about all these terms, political terms, but they don't specify what they mean. And often when that's the case, it is often because they try to use those terms in an abstract way to you know, hide or obscure the elite that really is running policy.
Exactly.
So
I got an article here that I thought was kind of funny. It says, only in America, South Carolina now requires subversives register. Terrorists who want to overthrow the United States government must register with South Carolina's Secretary of State and declare their intentions, or face a $25,000 fine and up to 10 years in prison. The State Subversive Activities Registration Act, passed last year, is now officially on the books and states every member of subversive organization or an organization subject to foreign control over foreign agents, or every person who advocates, teaches, advises, or practices custody for seizing or overthrowing the government of the United States shall register with the Secretary of State as a $5 filing fee.
Wow. Well, yeah, that's pretty messed up. Well, yeah, I mean,
if you needed a reason to move, if you live in South Carolina, needed another reason, that might be a pretty good one.
Wow. Well, I mean, if you live abroad, you're not safe either. Apparently, there was this news item that explained how now American citizens who are suspected of participating in terrorism, which of course we know can mean so many things, they can be murdered. You know, they say, well, you know, if you're an American citizen, that will not save you from getting murdered by the by our government if we think you are a threat to national security. So, you know, you're not safe anywhere now, it seems. But you know, that, you know, I've said this a few times already, but, you know, it's sort of like, it's not hard to find situations where we see clearly how the state becomes the worst enemy of the people they claim to protect. We've seen it throughout history. You know, how many citizens have been murdered by their own governments under the guise of protection or prosperity? You know, and corporations and other, you know, this what I was talking about earlier, workplace illness, injury. All this happens in the context of all these institutions, economic institutions, that claim to be here for our own good.
It's a strange world we live in.
Right. So is there anything else you wanted to talk about?
Well, she had mentioned that there was a call for a Fifth International. I think it was mostly Hugo Chavez behind it, but calling for a Fifth International. And I was just reading on a Trotskyist website how they're not huge fans of Chavez.
Yeah.
Saying that given Chavez's own lack of enthusiasm for workers' rights, such as recent strikes and factory occupations in Venezuela, when these have not been given the green light by himself and the PSUV, it is completely crazy to see him as the instrument, consciousness, or otherwise of the world revolution. Anyone like Woods, who depends on this mass pressure to change Chavez and advocating a false, indeed a disastrous course for the workers' revolution in Venezuela, this could only come by building a Leninist revolutionary party on the basis of a Trotskyist transitional program. Maybe that's their own take on it, but I think it represents a lot of people on the having a skeptical view of Chavez.
Well, yeah, but that last comment is sort of, what's that saying from the frying pan into the fire, something like that? yeah, we don't want Chavez. We want our own vanguard party. That should be the solution. No, I mean, of course there are problems with the Venezuelan example. I think some people on the left, the thing is that we on the left are so goddamn desperate that anytime there's anything that has any qualities that are a little bit redeeming in terms of opposing the United States, having something to do with maybe some welfare measures and improvement in worker conditions, or even some collectives or anything with a little bit of a leftist tinge, we already look at with with a lot of glee and
grab onto it.
Right. So I mean, the thing is that the thing with about Chavez is that. Clearly, there have been some positive things going on, but let's face it, it's not a libertarian socialist movement. He has made statements against anarchists and so on. Now, that doesn't mean that it's not better than, say, an area dominated by the United States, because at least what's happening, there's a decentralization of power away from the United States. Of course, it decentralizes itself in a more authoritarian manner, which we would like to see dissolved. But it's complicated.
I actually went to a discussion group on this book that came out from AK Press called Venezuela Speaks: Voices from the Grassroots. So it was a group of people that wanted to kind of make it clear that this isn't a completely top-down revolution, but what Chavez calls the Bolivarian revolution. They do see a lot of action in the barrios, grassroots action, people organizing themselves without the use of the state, even anarchist movements inside the country that perhaps, like you said, there's a, when you have a leftist government in place, it kind of opens up a space for these things to take hold, where they won't be so suppressed. You couldn't see this happening in Colombia under Uribe, but you have a situation where there's a little bit of opening for some of these grassroots movements to organize themselves and coalesce and gain a certain momentum. And actually, Chavez did issue I guess you would call it a title to a house, like an actual, like in the barrios, those people that had no right to ownership of where they were living previously, and now they have documentation of their right to own where they live.
Right. I mean, there are some positive developments, and I remember Michael Albert saying back in the some talk last year when I went to Boston that very often people on the left say, if we don't get the whole thing right away, it's like, we give up. Very often we have to settle for small improvements and just work from there. So, if you want, we can go through some of the... are you on IM, Paul? Maybe you should get on IM, and I can send you some stuff while we're on.
But... I it would take me probably more than 5 minutes to get my item figured out.
Well, that's fine. I guess I'll just go through these, and next time we meet, we can plan to do that. But in 1881, the Russian novelist Fyodor Dostoevsky died. And I don't know if you guys have read any of his stuff, but it's definitely worth reading. And he's a radical thinker, so definitely worth reading some of his stuff. 1909, the United States' first federal legislation prohibiting narcotics, actually opium. That was passed 1909, and of course today is February 9th. Then we jump all the way to 1994, and this is when the Senate report reveals that the United States government shipped biological warfare agents to Iraq. Ronald Reagan approved this before the Gulf War, and it led to all kinds of horrible consequences, as we know.
See, they did have WMD after all, because we gave it to them.
Right, we got the receipts. Right, that was the that was a good one. 95, Mexico, the government cancels peace process. Troops invade Chiapas, strongholds of Zapatista rebels, following the demand by an advisor to U.S. Chase Manhattan Bank that the government eliminate them. It says, in the name of investor confidence, a powerful U.S. bank is calling on the Mexican government to crush the Zapatista insurgency in Chiapas. Now, I may add a poll that this is sort of a pattern Chomsky and Herman reported on how a lot of the oppression in the third world has which of course benefits those who try to crush labor unions and labor rights. Those are very closely interlinked with the desire of these foreign investors to reap a profit from their investments.
Yeah, absolutely, and we don't hear about these things in the mainstream media either. You know, if the Zapatistas accomplish anything, or if they are suppressed in any way, we don't hear anything about it in America, or unless you're tuned into radical media, which is sad, because these are people that they're fighting for their indigenous rights to the land that they were born on, their ancestors were born on, and they'd like some autonomy, and it's not they're not asking for all that much, just to be left alone and allowed to organize themselves economically the way that they see fit.
So today, 10 years ago in Mexico, they had the biggest demonstration in 12 years. More than 100,000 people demonstrated, demanding the liberation of students arrested when police regained control of the country's main campus, closed by a 9-month strike. This was a demonstration with trade unions, leftist groups, the parents of the detainees, students, et cetera, et cetera. So we're close to the end of the show, so I want to thank you, Paul, for calling in. I want to thank our listeners, and we will be here tomorrow again, and we want to encourage you to call in, get involved, visit the website authoritiesmasters.wordpress.com, and we'll see you in a few few hours tomorrow when we come back. So
90
good
seconds.
Night. And I'm going to play Muse, I guess, uprising, and we will be back. Ciao.